Fortress London, Why We Need to Save the Country from Its Capital, is the new book by Sam Bright. It's a vividly written and timely polemic tackling the burning injustices shaping British society today. Journalist Sam Bright is a northerner living in London. He's just one of the millions of people clinging onto the coattails of the capital, sucked in by the prospect of opportunities that the rest of the United Kingdom does not enjoy. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from London, author of Fortress London, Sam Bright. Sam, good morning to you.
Morning.
Good to have you with us. London, where the streets are paved with gold and a man can earn his fortune. Who isn't sucked in by the bright lights and unending prospects of the country's capital?
Well, exactly. You've sort of described the Victorian myth of London, haven't you? Yeah, like you said in the intro, sucked me in as well as one of these doughy-eyed northerners into the capital, you know, a good many years ago to try and find prospects in this city. My book really says that London's not working for anybody. That promise has been unrealized now, for both Londoners and for people moving in from outside of London.
Now, when we talk about, you know, sucked in from the north, let's just qualify that for me. So which particular part of the north where are you from?
I'm from Huddersfield, or Uddersfield as we call it. We drop our H's. So in West Yorkshire.
Do you think it's a particular thing then, though, because, you know, people coming from, if you're not in a Manchester or if you're not in a Liverpool or one of the big urban centres, one of these northern powerhouses we keep hearing about, which we'll come on to a bit later. But do you think it's part of that almost, you know, the Billy Liar sort of thing, that you move to London because that's where it's all happening, man?
Yeah, I mean, I think to some extent you're suggesting sort of the sort of illusion of London, the sort of, you know, what it promises to be. But in a large degree, London is that as well. I think it's not just that Manchester and Leeds can compete with London, and we choose to move to London because London's got the branding attached to it that, you know, it seems like this mythical place where everything is happening. It literally is the place where everything is happening. For example, the media, which I can speak to very directly, you know, being my profession. Unfortunately, you know, since the Manchester Guardian decided to not be the Manchester Guardian anymore and decided to be the, you know, the North London Guardian, and no criticism to it because I think it has to be to operate as a national title, all of the big national newspapers, for example, they're all holed up in London, in various places in London. You know, you've got great regional titles, brilliant, you know, Manchester Evening News, Liverpool Echo, Yorkshire Post, phenomenal regional titles. But in terms of national journalism, apart from a bit of broadcast scattered here and there, you don't really have the opportunity. And unfortunately, that's applicable to a lot of different like high level professions, you know, finance, the arts, politics, you know, they're all holed up in the capital. And as a result, the economic output of London and its productivity is way ahead and beyond anywhere else in the country.
So what you can almost argue that London has become somewhat like one of the city states of Italy, like a Venice, like a Florence, like a Genoa. They it's become disconnected with the rest of the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. In so many different regards, you can see this. So the economic output of London is between 30 and 50% higher than anywhere else in the country, you know, between the most performing regions and the least performing regions. Its house prices are double the England-wide average. But as a result of that, you also see mass poverty in the capital in a way that you don't see in other areas of the country. So this is an issue that I was really keen not to sidestep because, I think that London needs to be saved from itself to some extent. So if you put all the impoverished people in London and you move them to a different city, that city would be the second largest in the UK. It would be double the size of Birmingham. That's the extent to which London has a problem with itself now as well.
And that's because, I mean, it has become almost like this cuckoo type of city-state, if you like, because it's feeding on itself, it's attracting the mega wealthy, and we're seeing them all on our social media, and we're seeing them in the media, and we're seeing them reported, and you're thinking, okay, well, this is where you can make a fortune. But for the vast majority of people who move there from low incomes, both from elsewhere, you know, from the UK, other regions of the UK, and also from, you know, from overseas, they become, if you like, service or just, you know, just living just above or just below the breadline, and feeding those who are extremely wealthy. And we've seen them move in the past 10 years. In Ireland, in London 30 years ago, and the difference now and then is absolutely huge. And I could never imagine being, you know, a young student living in London now, because friends tell me in the prices, and, you know, my eyes start watering immediately.
Yeah, and I'm really worried about this, because I think that we're moving to a previous era of economic development here. We're creating, in a sense, a new aristocracy, in not just in the capital, but in the country as a whole, which is the London landowning class, the London property owning class. So I calculated by looking at property inflation, if someone bought a property in Yorkshire, where I'm from, for £50,000 in 1980, and someone bought a property for the same value in London at the same time, by now, the London property would be worth almost twice as much, would be worth 800,000 versus 400,000. And I think that has some major problems for the country, because essentially that increase in assets is unearned. Someone's just sat in a property in the capital for 40 years and has seen essentially the assets that they can pass through the generation to their children, et cetera, double. And so if you own property in the capital now, not only can your kids take advantage of the massive amounts of internship opportunities, low wage and early stage career prospects that the capital holds in its grasp, but then they get the benefit of that property wealth, you know, down the generations when eventually it's liquidated. And I think that's a major problem right now.
And a lot of those areas of London are rebranding themselves. I mean, I lived in Battersea, which was originally a sort of working class area down there, and all that Clapham area, and it suddenly set up. So we suddenly had Battersea and St. Wrytham, and I have for Streatham, and I have friends who are living in Queen's Park, last time I was there was kind of a railway terminal, and it's now being branded as North Kensington. So, I mean, you know, and he's got a place, and I lived on Brockwell Park, and before then, and that's in, you know, in Brixton area, and Brixton and all that area, Effra Road, Telford, had a complete change in the gentrification, and suddenly friends of mine who bought houses 30 years ago there are now living in £1 million places for doing exactly what you did, basically doing nothing and sitting and watching the property prices go up through inflation.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Battersea is a really instructive case in all this. I mean, if you look at Battersea now, like, I describe it in the book as sort of like a Blade Runner type dystopia, because you've got these like pillars, these grey pillars going up that have been bought and developed by Malaysian property development companies. The Skypool, if you remember the Skypool story from, I think it was last year or the year before, this pool that's suspended between two luxury development flats in Battersea that's owned by some sort of sovereign wealth fund. It's absolutely bizarre. It's sort of wealth that's gone to a completely ludicrous level in the capital. And that's essentially what you've got. You've got London that has been bought and owned by oligarchs right now. And even London's like landmarks are owned by oligarchs. So I point out in the book that City Hall, the pantheon of democracy in the capital, is owned by Q8. Like, and that whole area surrounding City Hall is owned by Q8. The Shard is owned by, I believe it's Qatar. The walkie-talkie is owned by a company that specializes in Chinese-style food sources, you know, and we've seen Russian oligarchs, you know, buy up huge swathes of the capital. And I think as a result, as you say, it sort of has a knock-on effect, has a chain reaction. Middle-class people then get pushed further out, and the people who inhabited those communities, perhaps probably immigrant communities, they got knocked out further. And you just create this sort of seething disenfranchisement and resentment within the capital itself.
If we go back to sort of that Victorian era, then it was saying the great disparities between rich and poor there, you know, if you look at that in London, in a part of London's story, but at least in those days you had London philanthropists. So you would have somebody like a Guinness who built the you know, the social housing around Stamford Bridge. If you go there now, and you'll see those you know, those flats, and you'll see that, you know, that there was an idea of giving back to communities. And obviously, if you've got a Malaysian trust fund or Kuwaiti what's it fund or a Chinese food product, they don't want to put anything in back to the community. They just want to take. They just want to have a prestige building in an international financial capital that welcomes you in with open arms. If you've got a certain amount of money, and you know, and the rest of you can spend 5 hours commuting in every day to clean the floors.
Yeah, exactly. It's a safety, I describe it as like a safety deposit box for these people. All they want to do is pile their money in and see it accrue and accrue and accrue. And they've got, you kind of can't blame them for doing that, right? Because they're like, they're investors. Like their modus operandi is like earn money. Like we know that. The thing is that we've allowed them to do this. We've let the free market sort of rampage through London and consume its assets that haven't then been delivered back into ordinary people's pockets. So we've got to question like how exactly we regulate the market to stop that from happening.
Let's look at what happens, though, politically with this, because if London's got a disproportional amount of attention and power and wealth in it, then that makes sort of having control of London perhaps disproportionate. And if you look at the way that the Labour Party has gone from being the party of the trade unions to the party of the North, the Islington intelligentsia, that's been a remarkable turnaround, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. And it's really intensified over the last 12 years. We've seen a real split both in the Labour Party and in the country, really. There's been this sort of cleavage between older, working class, less well-educated constituencies in the north. And then in all the other metropolitan hubs, and in particular in London, you've got this really sort of young, diverse, well-educated population. And they've cleaved on political lines as well. So the north has voted for Brexit, you know, many of those poor areas in the north have voted for Brexit, and the metropolitan hubs have voted against Brexit and in favour of the Labour Party. And we obviously saw this last week on Thursday and Friday in the local elections. Labour did very well in London and perhaps didn't do as well in the Red Wall as it was hoping to do. And I make the case, I did after I saw those results come in, that that's quite politically dangerous for the Labour Party because if it starts even more embodying London than it already does, if its representatives are concentrated so heavily in the capital, then it's going to alienate the rest of the country, because the rest of the country just does not look like London in any stretch of the imagination.
I mean, that's the other thing as well, because, you know, I'm from Stoke-on-Trent. I mean, you look towards London and it's a different country, and it really is. And, you know, coming saying to, quote unquote, the left-wing media, you know, get out of London, go and look at the rest of the country and to see how people are really thinking. Now, I don't normally quote Dominic Cummings as a reliable source, but when you see things coming in and you see, you know, the swathe of places like Stoke-on-Trent that voted for Brexit and have become part of that, you know, that red wall that disappeared and crumbled and still keeps voting because London now has an image. It may have an image with, you know, Kuwaiti fund managers being a place to invest, but from people, you know, from people north of Banbury or whatever, it just seems, and then those northern industrial powerhouses that people go on, it just seems that London is serving itself, and so therefore there's a massive distrust of what they see as trendy, urban, woke, quote-unquote, Londoners.
Yeah, and I think there's a real problem with the progressive movement here in that it sort of sustained London's perception of itself and sustained these regional inequalities. It sort of said, don't get on London's back. London's perfect. London's liberal. It's diverse. It's the rest of the country that should need to sort its business out, frankly. Whereas that offends all, I mean, if you thought about any other form of inequality, economic class inequality, whatever, the left would be trying to erode those inequalities. But where regions are concerned, it sort of believes in this perverse regional Darwinism where it's survival of the regional fittest. And if you're not good enough, if you're not strong enough as London, then you're not going to prosper. And we're kind of fine with that because we're liberal and we're enlightened. And I think that, as you say, I think that really alienates people in other parts of the country.
Regional Darwinism. I like that one. I like that one a lot. So there's been a lot of talk of levelling up. We have a levelling up minister. We talk about there's always this lip service to northern powerhouses, which seems a great saying. But, you know, with the exception of maybe the BBC putting stuff in Salford, there doesn't seem to have been that much sort of investment, if you like, really, in that thing. And also, being London-centric pushes the case for the areas of the UK, and, you know, obviously I'm talking about Scotland here, to push their independence, because they see London as government and industry and the media as being incredibly inward-looking.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think one stat that I saw that was produced actually by the Northern Powerhouse Partnership that really struck me was that Boris Johnson, who, as you say, rhetorically has been really, you know, heavy on levelling up and regional rebalancing, Boris Johnson does not plan on spending more on English regional development than Theresa May or David Cameron. So for all his grand rhetoric, actually, when you get into the numbers, he doesn't plan on spending vast amounts of cash. Essentially, what levelling up is at the minute is an election tool for the Conservative Party. The National Audit Office, which is an independent spending watchdog, has said this. Basically, the Conservative Party wants to invest in like a railway station here, a shopping centre here, something that it can put on an election leaflet and say, we're investing in your local area. But in terms of really fundamental infrastructure projects that maybe don't sound as cool, it's not really bothering with those, or, you know, building new schools, or, you know, paying teachers better or stuff like that. It's just not happening. And like you say, I mean, this creates a massive problem with Scotland and Wales, particularly Scotland at the minute. I mean, it seems as long as Vote Leave flies its flag over Downing Street, that Scotland will want to extract its colours from the Union Jack.
So it would be easy to just do a polemic about, well, you know, London's just rubbish, basically. But, you know, where do we go from here? How can London reinvent itself? What did you do to plan to set out this book? Because it's not just a rant against London and saying, well, London is a city state. It just feeds on itself and it's using the rest of the country for raw energy, basically, and forget the regions. Are there examples of cities that have turned this round, have readdressed this imbalance? And who did you speak to? And you know, what do you think we need to do?
Well, the thing is that I think it's going to be immensely difficult. I don't sugarcoat it, and I think it would be naive to sugarcoat it. This is a massive effort that will probably take generations. Germany is a really instructive example of how they've done things right, as usual. So essentially you've got like heats of power in different parts of Germany. You've obviously got Berlin, that's like a political and a cultural center. You've got Frankfurt, that's a cultural center. You've got the industrial West with Dortmund, and Dortmund's actually an example that I use of, a former industrial area that sort of rejuvenated itself in the professional economy. It's now the insurance heart of Germany. The more insurance jobs there than anywhere else. And you can't imagine that in the UK. We've concentrated all those things in one city. So essentially you've got to think, how exactly do we export, do we outsource some of London's power to different cities? My big argument is that the one thing we really have control over is the centre of political power. And that's, you know, you're not going to get Canary Wharf to move tomorrow. That's just not going to work. The banks are going to either leave or they're going to resist. But you can move where Parliament sits. And I think moving Parliament to a different area of the country, I propose Leeds, probably for very Yorkshireman-like reasons. But you could move it to Birmingham. You could move it to, you know, Manchester, potentially. You know, I think that would have a really big symbolic effect. And it would also push loads of civil servants, loads of journalists, as you say, would be forced to move up north. Loads of companies that get government contracts, they would have to move further north. And you'd create a new political and economic heartland that may redress the balance somewhat.
And you say forced to move up north, but let's fly the flag here, because, you know, Manchester, Leeds, they are, you know, Birmingham, Sheffield, Liverpool have reinvented themselves since we had urban regeneration. You know, in those years, Cardiff, I mean, I went to Cardiff Bay 30 years ago as a journalist and was shown around and thought, this is never going to happen. Yeah, never. And once again, I was proved wrong, because everybody was looking at the Reichman brothers and Canary Wharf, because it was London centric. And I remember standing there where Cardiff Bay was going to be and seeing that that stock exchange building, and thought, and now a Cardiff Bay is a jewel. Same with Leeds, armories, etc. All that area, you know, all those canals that we thought we used to have shopping trolleys in them. And so, you know, there is, if you think about it, and don't think of the north as, you know, as the saying, when it's grim up north. You know, you're working in a business, forget about the weather, because you're in the UK. I mean, surely it makes sense in commuting and getting around, you know, none of this 5 hours on the Northern Line thing. And that would make sense. Perhaps it's a perception, because again, London's become inward looking, that there is life beyond the end of the Metropolitan Circle line.
Well, exactly. And it works in one of two ways. Either the civil servants and the journalists move up north and they realise that it's a lot better. It's not grim up north. and they can afford things a lot more cheaply than they could, and they, you know, they go to a nice school and perhaps live in a rural area that borders Leeds, you know, have a, you know, better quality of life. Or they decide to stay in London, right? And because we've moved all their colleagues up north, houses are a lot cheaper in London. So they can afford to, like, my big argument is that by incubating pockets of heat elsewhere in the country, you're not punishing London, you're helping London, you're making London cheaper, you're pushing poverty rates down in the capital. It helps everybody. This should be a national mission, as frankly, as far as I'm concerned, rather than pitting like this area against this area, we're going to come take your wealth. All we want is for the country to grow in harmony. And that seems a perfectly reasonable thing to suggest.
Sam, what do you hope that people take from this, apart from looking at, obviously, you know, the Leeds house prices suddenly shooting up as a result of this interview?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that regional inequality is sort of like on the radar, is back on the radar. I know we've talked about it a lot with the red wall, Brexit, 2019 general election, but I think we've talked about it in quite a divisive way, as I've kind of alluded to. I think it's, you know, it's been regional competition. I think it's been like one area against another. I want to put regional inequality back on the map as like, this is a thing that has like a really vital impact to people's life chances in this country. But also it's in our collective national interest to get this sorted. So let's just like get behind it together.
The book is called Fortress London, Why We Need to Save the Country from Its Capital. It's by Sam Bright, who we're speaking to today. Sam, if people want to follow you on the socials or on the web, where can they find you?
They can find me at Writes Bright, so Writes as in writing.
And the book's going to be available as well. You can order it via our virtual bookstore. The book is called Fortress London, Why We Need to Save the Country from Its Capital. It's by Sam Bright. Looking forward to your second book, It's Lovely in Leeds, which should be coming out next year. But no, this book is Fortress London. It's by Sam Bright. Sam, thank you so much for your time today.
Cheers. Appreciate it.